This is Law and Disorder.
We have a most extraordinary guest, Andrea Legge, age 85, speaking to us from Paris on the way the French tortured him 50 years ago in Algeria.
Legge, a French journalist, supported the Algerian fight against colonialism. As a result, he's picked up and he's waterboarded, electroshock, and other unspeakable acts. We'll see how that relates to what our country, what the United States, is doing today.
We've got California constitutional rights attorney Marjorie Cohn.
Marjorie's an expert on the Military Commission Act, the setting up of various detention facilities in the United States, and the threat that hundreds of thousands may be facing if and when this government cracks down even more.
We also have attorney Jim Lafferty, leader of the National Lawyers Guild in Southern California, and a longtime anti-war activist going back to when he led the coalition against the war in Vietnam.
Lafferty has done an incredible job in Southern California in helping organize a vigorous protest movement against the war.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We have an extraordinary, very special guest on Law and Disorder today, the author of the book, The Question, Andrea Legge, 85 years old, a French revolutionary. We've got him on the line from Paris to here in our studios in New York City. Andrea Legge was a supporter of the Algerians in their attempt to break free from French colonialism in the 50s. He was editor of a newspaper. As such, he was picked up by the French army, tortured for over a month. His book was written in his prison cell, smuggled out, became a sensation in Europe, helped bring down the French government that was oppressing the Algerians. The book has been reissued just last month. It's come out on Bison Books, the University of Nebraska Press. Ellen Ray is responsible for doing this. It's in English. The introduction is by Jean-Paul Sartre. Andre, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Ellen Ray, who was one of the people you worked with on your book, book is called The Question. When she talked to me about the book, I actually, to my ignorance, didn't really know of it. And, of course, it hadn't been published in a number of years. And then I got a copy of the book, and the book is called The Question, and it has an introduction by Ellen Ray, then has the original preface by Jean-Paul Sartre, which I thought was really good, and then it has your description of what happened to you when you were taken into custody in Algeria during the war.
Yes.
And tell me about the name. The name of the book is called The Question.
Yes.
And why is that?
First of all, the word The Question in French has a different meaning than in other languages. It means, of course, the question, a simple question. But in the same time, it means torture. At the time of the royalty in France, in the time of the way justice was given and ordered, at that time, you said, we will give him the question. That means we will torture him and try to ask him the answer to what interest is for us in his arrest. In different languages, Spanish, in Italian, in German, they called the book the torture, because it didn't mean anything in German or Italian or Spanish. That's why it was called The Question, because in the same time, you see there's a, can you call that a pun? In the book, there is only one question asked by the people who torture. they want to break the strength of resisting of the man they have in hand, and they think that if he answers the first question, he must give answers to the other questions. But if he resists the first question, so it's useless to ask him other questions. So that is why the word, the question, in the title of the French book means torture, and also it refers to what is inside the book and what I answer to the torturers.
Okay, let me ask you, I want to give our listeners some background. You were in Algeria. Can you just give us the time period and how you got arrested and what you were doing in Algeria?
Well, I landed, if I can say, in Algeria in 1939. I was 18 at the time, and it was not scheduled for me to stay in Algeria, but the war broke out. I stayed in Algeria, but very soon after the defeat of France, the Vichy government imposed to Algeria new fascist rules, and I stayed in Algeria and quickly joined the resistance movement against the oppression of the Algerian people by French colonialism. So that was my first stand. Then I became the editor of the only anti-colonialist newspaper in Algeria. The name of the paper was Alger Républicain, nothing in common with the American party called Republicans, of course.
We're speaking with Henri Alleg. Henri Alleg was a French-Algerian journalist, the author of a book on his torture that took place in Algeria in the 50s. The book is called The Question. Henri, after you were picked up, can you give our listeners some description of the way in which you were tortured?
Well, you know, nothing very new. I think what happened just in our time with prisoners in Iraq, also in Guantanamo and other prisons, they took the model from the French. As you know, what happened in some countries of Latin America, their teachers, if you can call them that way, were ex-French officers who were brought to the country to teach police and army how to manage with people who fought against dictatorship in these countries. So I was, in fact, I was put under, I knew already, because in my work of Alger Républicain as a journalist, many, many Algerian patriots would come after having been arrested, that was before the war, and tell us about the tortures they had suffered. That is, well, drowning.
One of the most moving parts of the book was when you describe what you said as drowning, what they now call, at least under U.S. regime of torture, waterboarding.
Yes.
And I'm going to read a couple of sentences from what you said about it, and then I think you want to, as Michael Smith mentioned, the Center for Constitutional Rights, we filed a case in Germany against Rumsfeld and others for waterboarding and other issues.
Yes.
And if you go to our website, which is ccr-ny.org, and you go to the German complaint that we filed, and I don't know if you know this, we opened the complaint with a description from your book of three paragraphs of the waterboarding that happened to you or the drowning. And it's quite remarkable because in this country, of course, they're claiming that waterboarding does not constitute torture. Maybe you can give a response to that and what it felt like for you a little bit, if you want to do that.
It's bringing someone to the brink of death. And it's not only a great sufferance as if you were drowning, but also a sort of terrible agony, terrible feeling of dying. You're dying. You know you're dying. Tell you that if you move your fingers, it will seize. And if you don't, you're going to die. So it's a strong torture, and perhaps even more terrible, because you have to fight against the anxiety of not being able to bear two or three times that feeling of death.
Now, Henri, I remember when I read the book, you said the first time you didn't realize it was going to happen, and you didn't, something with your fingers, so that your fingers moved involuntarily.
Yes.
And then the next time you took some action so that didn't happen. Can you just describe that?
Yes, well, I prefer death than a new trial of that feeling of going again and again near the brink of dying. The terrible thing to hear that some responsible people can say that such an experience is not torture.
Well, this is what the leaders of the United States of America are, in fact, saying.
What you wrote in the book is amazing about this. What after your fingers moved the first time, what you said was, in spite of myself, the fingers of both my hands shook uncontrollably.
Yes.
That's it. He's going to talk, said a voice. And then the next time they did this to you, which was right afterwards, they had you strapped to a board and put your head under a faucet with a towel over it. And this time you said, this time I clenched my fists, forcing the nails into my palm.
Yes.
I decided I was not going to move my fingers again.
Yes.
It was better to die of asphyxiation right away.
Yes.
I feared to undergo again that terrible moment when I had felt myself losing consciousness. So that's the experience of it.
Henri, you were supportive of the Algerian People's Movement for Independence.
Yes.
And that's what led you into the hands of the French.
Yes.
Can you give us a little background about what you were trying to accomplish and why they picked you up and why they tortured you?
Well, at that time, you know, the only acceptable political stand was to repeat what the French government said, and that was Algeria is a part of France. Algerian, although they were considered as inferior, are French, and the fact of speaking of another regime for the Algerian people was considered as a crime. Of course, the paper I was leading, Alger Républicain, was suppressed, and I had to go to the underground.
Approximately what year was this?
It was in, the war started in 54, November 54, the first upsurge of the Algerian national movement. I was arrested in 1957. In June 57, I had been underground for 2 years. So when the paratroopers arrested me, they wanted me to give the names of people, militants, with whom I was linked. That's why they tortured me. But at that time, and even before the war, tortured was just an ordinary way of proceeding with people arrested. So the book I wrote, of course, was considered as a personal testimony, but in fact, what I was writing, because I was a journalist, was the fate of all people, say 95% of the people who were arrested, thousands of them, many more than thousands, tens of thousands of Algerian prisoners were tortured. Many of them died under torture. My friend, Maurice Audin, a very well-known name now, was also arrested, tortured, and he was killed under torture. I wrote that book in my cell. It was in the prison of Algiers. It was rather a difficult thing to do because we were searched every day. The cell was searched. I had to have friends who helped me to hide the pages I wrote. And after that, it was also very difficult to take them, to have them out of the prison. So out of the prison, it was sent by people who attorneys, lawyers, etc., who came to Algiers, and it was printed in Paris, but very quickly it was forbidden.
It was printed while you were still in prison, is that right?
Yes, of course. Yes. I was still in prison at that time.
And it was forbidden in France?
Forbidden in France, so it was printed illegally by different people, some organizations, and many trade unions printed it illegally. It was printed also in Switzerland, I mean, in countries where French printers, and taken also illegally through frontier to France. So it had a very important, enormous impact at that time, because what the French government said, that people who were talking of torture, people who testified against the French army, were enemies of the French government. What they said was only slanders against the army and against France, which was a country, as everyone knows, that could not torture people and could not do such things. So, and that stand kept on until 2 or 3 years ago. Yes, until 2000, it was the official stand of the French government was there has never been any tortures in Algeria, and the people who try to slander the action of the French army in Algeria are enemies of France. In the same time, enormous when you think of it, the French authorities refused to call what had been the conflict in Algeria, to call it a war. They spoke of pacification, of a fight for civilization, and such sentences, but nothing of the reality of that terrible war.
You know, Henri, we're speaking with Henri Alleg, the author of a very, very important book called The Question, which has just been reissued by the University of Nebraska Press. Henri Alleg is on the phone with us from Paris. He's 85 years old. He was a supporter of the Algerian Revolution, and that's why he was picked up by the French and tortured. And we want to kind of bring this up to current times, Henri. I think many of our listeners are familiar with the famous movie, The Battle of Algiers. And in fact, the United States government is showing that movie to American soldiers to teach them how to suppress an urban guerrilla uprising. I think to teach them the lessons of how you torture people on the bottom and try to implicate people from the bottom up, build a pyramid and try to capture the leaders. They're being educated by that movie. So I think a lot of our listeners have a little bit of an idea of what's going on here with American government policy. How would you relate the defeat of the French government in its attempt to suppress the Algerian Revolution with what's going on with the United States, its use of torture, and its attempt to control Iraq?
Well, first of all, referring to the Battle of Algiers, although the film is a good film, and what is shown in the film is the truth, the Battle of Algiers is not very significant of the whole war of Algeria, because the war was led most in the countryside. First, what happened in Algiers was not a main point, although it was important. It was not there that the fight between the Algerian peasants and partisans was the most significant. It was not. And then, under torture, of course, some people gave information. But on the whole, the information was not very, very important.
If you have any message for the people in the United States, considering you're looking back over probably some 7 decades of political struggle as a revolutionary, as a supporter of the colonial revolution, and as a journalist, what would you tell the people of the United States now, considering the position the American government is in?
I would say that the American people should be very careful not to be led in some terrible and unforgettable way by these politicians that speak of liberty, speak of the respect of man, of the rights of man, and do exactly the contrary of what they expose, they say. We have had that experience in France, and finally, although there were hundreds of thousands of Algerians killed in that war, in spite of the death also of 30,000 young Frenchmen in that war, finally, the people of Algeria got their independence. So that will of the Algerian people was stronger than any kind of torture and of the terrible sufferances they put to the Algerian people. That's the truth, that it is really impossible to win a war, even a long war. It's impossible, finally, to win a war against millions and millions of people who are convinced that their country must be free and who are really convinced that they will go to the end of their efforts to win the independence of their country.
Henry, thank you. That was really moving. And I want to go back just briefly to your story again. You're picked up by the French army in 1957.
Yes.
And how quickly did they begin to torture you and interrogate you?
Well, it was exactly a few hours after they arrested me.
And they began by doing what to you to begin?
Well, first of all, it was electricity.
They used electricity.
Electricity. And then fire, you know, the papers like torches. I was hanged by the legs, the feet, and my head was, of course, near the ground. And so they burnt me with these torches, again electricity, and then water, and then also what they called in French, sérum de la vérité, the truth serum that's used in some places to put the man they torture under some sort of fever and try to get out what he doesn't want to say willingly.
So they use torches, they use electricity, and when you referred to water, that you're referring to the drowning and the waterboarding, right?
Yes.
And for how long a period did you undergo this?
Well, it lasted for about 3 days and three nights.
And after that, what happened?
And after that, they, of course, made lies, telling me that they torture my wife. They had arrested my wife. And in that building where tortures were used, many women were also arrested. And during the night, I could hear the women arrested scream under torture. And I thought that I recognized the voice of my of my wife. And then they prepared to shoot me, as they did with other prisoners. So my friend, I was arrested at his house. He had been arrested a day before. He was tortured and probably killed under torture. And then they asked me to accompany them, and I supposed that they had prepared to shoot me. But something happened. I don't know exactly what. Maybe the fact that my friend had been killed, that stopped them at that time. so after a month in that house of torture, they led me to concentration camp. And in that concentration camp, the paratroopers could take anyone they wanted without any notice to the judge or to any regular legal organism. But during that month, I managed to make my fate known outside. It was known in France, so they could not go further. The fact that my friends in France and in different papers, I was known as the editor of a newspaper, they asked the government and the judges to send me to prison if they had something against me, and not to keep me in that concentration camp, which was a very dangerous situation, because they could take you any time and bring you back to that house of torture.
You know, Emery, that's very similar, really, to what we have today at Guantanamo or Bagram or in Iraq, where they have people without any charges, and they're holding them indefinitely, and they're able to torture them or interrogate them coercively, whatever term, and there's no charges. And all our clients and all we're asking is you either release people or you charge them.
Well, you know that all these ways of acting, they called it the French school.
School.
It's a French school. They learned it from the war in Algeria and before also the war of Vietnam, but especially as the war in Algeria was so near France, and the soldiers that were sent to Algeria were young people who were doing their conscription time in Algeria, which was not the same in Vietnam, where the Vietnamese-French war was the professional soldiers. And in Algeria, during the 7 years of war, nearly 3 million young Frenchmen went to Algeria. So it's rather different.
André Alleg, thank you very much. You're the author of the just re-released book, The Question. The book was a sensation, a bring-down-the-government book when it came out in the late 50s in France underground. It's been reissued because of its total relevance to the situation in the United States. We want to thank Ellen Ray for her new introduction to the book and for getting it out in English. The Question by André Alleg, A-L-L-E-G. It's available from Bison Books, the University of Nebraska. You can get it on the internet. We urge all of our listeners to read André Alleg's book, The Question. André, you have our greatest admiration and respect. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, André, and for writing that book, which has been very significant
to all of us. Thank you to you, and I apologize to all the listeners for my rusty English.
Not rusted, really well, so thank you.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
We're delighted to have with us today Marjorie Cohn, the newly elected president of the National Lawyers Guild and an expert on constitutional law. Marjorie is going to talk about some of the new developments that perhaps weren't anticipated years ago in the aftermath of 9/11. Marjorie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure, Heidi.
Marjorie, where do you want to start on this? With the Military Commissions Act? What area would you like to start with?
I want to start with the Military Commissions Act.
Tell us a little bit about when it was passed, what it sort of embodies, and what you think some of its most dangerous features are.
Well, the Military Commissions Act was passed by Congress at the end of September, and it was signed by Bush 2 or 3 weeks later. The Military Commissions Act is ostensibly an act that was set up to provide rules for trying alleged terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, but it actually does much more than that. Significantly, it actually destroys the right to habeas corpus for non-citizens who have always enjoyed the right of habeas corpus under our Constitution. The Supreme Court has been very clear that, in fact, the words of the Constitution itself don't just apply to citizens, and habeas corpus can only be suspended in times of rebellion or invasion, and there's a pretty universal agreement that we have not been invaded by any country, and there is no rebellion going on. But in addition, there's a provision of the Military Commissions Act which has received almost no notice in the corporate media.
Before you go there, I want you to just give a little more explanation of what is habeas corpus, because some of our people don't know.
Habeas corpus, it's a right to go into court and say to the judge that I am being detained unlawfully. I'm innocent. I should not be locked up. And the problem is that once habeas corpus is denied to people, they can rot in prison the rest of their lives. Many people who were locked up in by mistake after 9/11 and who spent many years at Guantanamo before being released, and many of them are still there, most of them actually innocent, according to many human rights organizations, will never get to go into court and say, look, I'm innocent, you got the wrong guy. And so there's no way any court can ever release them, and that's an incredible threat to our very democracy.
This applies not just to people picked up in Afghanistan or non-citizens picked up anywhere in the world. It applies to actually non-citizens and legal permanent residents, et cetera, in the United States as well. Is that right? Okay, now I didn't want to interrupt your flow here, but your next point you were going to make, I think, about the Military Commission Act, which I actually sometimes call the Police State Act, but I guess you could refer to it however you want, but what was your next sort of point on it?
The Military Commissions Act gives the president the right to lock up unlawful enemy combatants, basically indefinitely. And the thing that we have not seen in the corporate media is that he can designate even U.S. citizens to be unlawful enemy combatants if the president decides that someone has purposefully and materially supported hostilities against the United States. So, say that people engage in anti-war rallies against U.S. policy, and the president decides, well, that's helping our enemy because they're opposed to the war in Iraq, or they're opposed to military recruitment. Or say that someone gives money to a charity, not knowing that that charity happens to be related to an organization that's on Bush's list of terrorist organizations. That person could also be declared an unlawful enemy combatant and locked up indefinitely. And I'm talking not just about non-citizens, I'm also talking about U.S. citizens.
Talk to us about the enemy combatant that we still have locked up here in the United States that people have just forgotten about.
Yes, well, Jose Padilla was arrested not on the battlefield in Afghanistan, but in Chicago, in the O'Hare Airport. And he was the one that John Ashcroft ceremoniously announced was the dirty bomber. He was making plans for a radioactive bomb. Whatever so-called evidence that might have linked Padilla to any dirty bombs came out, it came out through the torture of some prisoners that took place in some of the secret black CIA sites. So Jose Padilla is still languishing, U.S. citizen, not picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan, but in the U.S., and he's still languishing in prison, and it's not clear what will happen to him. And so if you take that provision of the Military Commissions Act that was just passed by Congress and signed by the President, and you notice that it is not limited to non-citizens, and you notice that even U.S. citizens can be picked up as unlawful enemy combatants, and you keep that in mind, and then you look at a press release that Halliburton put out on January 24th of this year, where they very proudly announced that their subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, received a $385 million contract to establish a detention center in an undisclosed location. Why? In the event of an emergency influx of immigrants into the U.S., or, and listen to this, to support the rapid development of new programs. Now, what do you suppose those new programs could be? Could they possibly be internment camps for U.S. citizens, the way we had during World War II, where both U.S. and non-U.S. citizens of Japanese, German, and Italian descent were locked up, thousands of them locked up in concentration camps? Well, keep in mind another recent development, and that is that the ACLU, pursuant to a Freedom of Information Act request, and actually lawsuit, received information, this is just earlier this month, about 2 weeks ago, that military officials were labeling anti-war activities as potential terrorism, and that Talon, which is the Terrorism Watch database that the military uses to track different groups, it's called Talon Threat and Local Observation Notice, had said, well, there is a potential for disruption to military recruiting by these anti-recruitment efforts. And the Talon report also talked about counter-recruitment rallies in Georgia and cited the Military Families Speak Out, Veterans for Peace, and Iraq Veterans Against the War. So now you have, if you put all these pieces together and connect the dots, you have a new law that lets the president declare anybody an unlawful enemy combatant, including U.S. citizens. You have Kellogg Brown & Root. By the way, Kellogg Brown & Root is the same outfit that constructed those notorious, infamous tiger cages during the Vietnam War, where the prisoners were hunched over in tiny little cages and suffered. It was torture, actually. And they're also, KBR is also constructing permanent cells, prison cells, at Guantanamo, which the Amnesty International referred to as the gulag of our times. And so you put together that provision about locking people up as unlawful enemy combatants, the KBR's construction of these facilities at undisclosed locations for the rapid development of new programs, the military that is classifying anti-war activity and anti-military recruitment activity as possible terrorist activity, and then you look at the Patriot Act, which most Congress people didn't read before they were guilt-tripped by Bush after 9/11 into signing it, which creates a crime called domestic terrorism, which Bush has been using to go against environmental activists and animal rights activists. And you put it all together, and you see not just a program that goes after immigrants and non-citizens, which is bad enough when we engage in racial profiling and target people who, just because they're not citizens, are suspected of doing things that there's no evidence that they've ever done, but U.S. citizens as well. I think that if people in this country really understood that what is going on here is an incredible grab of power by the president, eventually could declare martial law. That's another thing. In fact, there was a program that people have been talking about, 1984. It was called Rex 84, 1984, right? George Orwell comes to mind. This was Oliver North of Iran-Contra fame, who set up Rex 84, which called for FEMA to round up and detain 400,000 imaginary refugees that might flock over the border. And at the time, both Congress and the Justice Department, there were many people who were very concerned that this might apply to U.S. citizens. And it looks like that's being resurrected. And we have to ask ourselves, do we trust the Bush administration, which has lied to us consistently about why our young men and women and thousands of Iraqis are dying in Iraq, not to squelch any dissent to its policies by rounding up Americans, declaring them unlawful enemy combatants?
When you speak out like you did at the Lawyers Guild Convention or in your magazine articles or on the Internet or in your law school class, what do you tell people to do?
Well, I guess the most immediate thing to do is to make sure the democratically controlled Congress has to start standing up to the president and not allowing him to run roughshod over civil liberties and civil rights, to say nothing of education, health care, Medi-Cal, Medicare, those things that are traditionally democratic issues which we hear very, very little about because the Bush administration has succeeded in really usurping the national agenda and talking so much on the global war on terror that people forget that the biggest terrorism in the world has been created by the Bush administration and reaction to what the Bush administration has done, especially in the Middle East.
I'm not sure whether we have a disagreement or not. But in looking back over the sad history of the Democratic Party, I remember it was Truman, a Democrat, who launched the Cold War. It was Roosevelt, the Democrat, who put the Japanese in concentration camps. It was Johnson, a Democrat, who escalated the war in Vietnam. Whenever these people have been made to do the right thing, it's because there have been masses of people in the streets in a movement like the Civil Rights Movement or the anti-war movement. You know, I think we have to be clear to our listeners that we can't rely on these people. We have to pressure these people. In a better world, we'd have our own party and not have to rely on that particular party.
I agree with you completely, Michael. I mean, I'm not saying that the Democrats are the answer or necessarily a panacea, but this is one struggle, many fronts, and we used to say that in the 60s, and that's why I said demonstrations are so key, and I agree with you. We do not have the Civil Rights Act because the government, out of the goodness of its heart, decided to be fair. It's because thousands and thousands and thousands of people marched and sacrificed and gave their lives, and Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life as well, to pressure the government to do the right thing. And I think that that's the only way that things are actually going to change.
Marjorie, what is your advice to protesters who are perhaps afraid of the government's targeting of, as you mentioned, environmental activists, labeling them terrorists and possibly labeling anti-war activists as domestic terrorists?
If these people are frightened by what they see happening, and in fact they stay home, then the government will have won. And I think that the only way to confront that is for people in unprecedented numbers to go to the streets when there are anti-war protests, anti-globalization protests, because the government can only round up so many people. And I think that the other thing that's important is not just demonstrating, but also writing op-eds, writing letters, and speaking on programs such as yours, such as Law and Disorder, to educate people, because it is only when the public is educated that they will not stand for this.
Marjorie Cohn, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We're also proud and happy of your taking over the presidency of the National Lawyers Guild. We hope you'll be a regular guest on our program, and lots of luck to you. Thank you very much, Marjorie Cohn.
My pleasure, Michael, and everyone else.
Attorney Jim Lafferty, leader of the National Lawyers Guild in Southern California and a longtime anti-war activist going back to when he led the coalition against the war in Vietnam.
Lafferty has done an incredible job in Southern California in helping organize a vigorous protest movement against the war.
Jim Lafferty, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good morning. Good morning.
Jim, you've been organizing and active with the National Lawyers Guild and the anti-war movement, the various peace movements, since the 60s. We've been examining in this series here on Law and Disorder where this country's at, how we got here, and where we're going. And we wanted to ask your estimation politically of where we are today in America.
Well, dear, I wish I could give a more favorable report. I think on the one hand, what we might call and what we do call the people's movement is in good shape. But where we're at politically as a nation is terrible, of course, and I'm sure your earlier parts have covered that. Interesting studies have been done recently by British historians on the common factors in fascist governments. And if you look at the 14 common points of those governments, and they're all on a scale, of course, you realize that the United States government these days is too far along on each of those 14 points on the scale. So we've certainly increased the repression in this country to perhaps unparalleled heights than at any time, perhaps, in our country, although there have been other times of repression as well. That's very dangerous. One of the things about that that is so encouraging, though, is that despite the increased degree of repression, despite the fact that we now openly talk about torture, that we openly acknowledge that we wiretap innocent citizens' phones, that we keep people in detention without benefit of counsel, and all the other things that I'm sure you've been discussing, the people in this country have not been silenced. And that's more important than it might at first blush seem, of course, because the Patriot Act and all of these repressive measures are designed not to protect the American people in this so-called war on terrorism, but rather to protect the ruling elite in this country as it continues with its quest for world domination. It needs a quiescent public for that. It needs a frightened public for that. And they've had some measure of success with that. But as I say, the movement itself, the people's movement itself in the streets, independent of that political process, I think is perhaps as strong as it's ever been.
Maybe we're living in two different countries, so I want to hear what you say about this, Jim. From where I am right now, I think it's shocking the quiescence in this country over issues like torture, the war in Iraq, and others. I mean, I think, sure, there's people out there, but you know, we haven't had, since the war, we haven't had a massive demonstration that's been close to what we had before the war. People seem satisfied with letting torture continue. I'm just not convinced that what you're saying is right, so I'd like to hear you articulate it a little bit.
Let's take, for example, the war in Vietnam movement and the war against Iraq movement. In point of fact, it took 20,000 body bags coming home and many more years in Vietnam before the public opinion polls showed anywhere near the opposition to the war that we now show and just came out again in a poll yesterday. Sadly, but happily, we've only had 3,000 U.S. body bags come home, and we've already had tremendous demonstrations in this country, in many cases equaling the size. Now, you point out that many of those took place before the war started. Some of that, of course, we have to attribute to the fact that there is no draft. But nevertheless, considering that fact, the movement, I think, is still, in many ways, on pace with and ahead of where it was during Vietnam. You have the question of, certainly in this town at least, we're going to talk about that later, of the gains we've made with respect to space on the streets for protests without interference from the police department. Now, I would certainly agree with you. I would want to see millions of people marching in the streets with respect to the torture issue or the wiretapping issue. These are new issues in this country, and they do arise in a climate of great fear that has been instilled by the elite in this country. I think it will take some time for that to manifest. But, you know, when folks, at least in the Answer Coalition with which I work, when we demonstrate in the streets and bring tens of thousands of people into the streets, we are talking about torture. We're talking about wiretapping. We're talking about the repression of our immigrant sisters and brothers. We're not just talking about the war in Iraq. So there's also a certain homogenization of the movement now that may not have been true at other times. But I don't want to differ with you, Michael, if your point is that we don't have enough. If your point is that the American people should be more outraged than they are, I would certainly agree with that. But I haven't given up hope on the American people, and I think that if you have laws being passed in a country where even citizens can be afraid of being locked up or losing their citizenship and the keys thrown away, this is a new level of repression. It is perhaps not surprising that at its earliest stages we don't yet have as much expression in the streets as you and I would want to see. But we have in many ways more of that expression in the streets and that opposition than other countries who have found themselves marching in that direction towards fascism. I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture of it. I'm just trying to suggest that the people in this country have not yet been cowed.
I would agree to the extent they haven't been cowed. But I think you can, you know, life goes on in many American cities as the way it went on much before the war, from soccer games to eating in nice restaurants to... So they haven't been cowed, but they're not doing anything.
During McCarthyism, that was true during the...
Of course it was.
The Palmer raids, it was true during Vietnam, of course.
But that's why those things went on. And
they finally ended because people did finally rise up.
The question here is, if you look at now, I mean, yes, it's getting... The Iraq situation certainly has changed in the country. But in part, and like it was in Vietnam in part, it's because of the deterioration in the country where the war is going on. I mean, you can't look at Iraq now and say, you know, when Bush lands on the aircraft carrier 2 years ago, sure, the American people are not going to do anything. But over 2 years, you've gotten, you know, this month is going to be over 100 American servicemen killed, most likely, and, you know, thousands and thousands of others. So it's not that people are growing, you know, more conscious all of a sudden. It's that the situation for the United States is deteriorating and people are saying, look what's happening.
Well, but that's often the case. I mean, people operate off of their own enlightened self-interest. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, we would all wish that people would be noble beyond the question of their self-interest. That's why I mentioned the point before about the draft. The fact of the matter is, when we did have a draft, and I do not want to see a draft again, of course, for other reasons, but when you had a draft, people then felt the pinch more directly. That's always true. One would wish that there was more nobility in the human being than there is, but to the extent that they eventually learn what their self-interest is, they operate off of it. We who try to help people understand that and organize them are finding more and more people indeed understanding that what is going on in Iraq, with or without a draft, is affecting their incomes at home, affecting their jobs at home, affecting quality of life, affecting their freedoms here in this country.
No, I think there's a growing consciousness of that.
That's all I'm saying.
I do think there's been a real problem in the anti-war movement. I mean, maybe less so in Los Angeles. Certainly with the national groupings, there just is not that much going on. And I don't know who to blame, to be honest.
This Saturday, we're going to have huge demonstrations. Whether they'll be as large as some that we've had in the past, no. It's an election year. People are always duped into believing they can elect their way out of a war, which, of course, they can't do. We learned that during Vietnam. The Vietnam War ended under Republican presidents, and it ended when it did because of the victories on the battlefield of the Vietnamese and because of the massive anti-war movement at home, not because of Nixon and Ford. Before every election year, people are still duped into believing there's a sufficient difference between Democrats and Republicans, and they can elect themselves out of the war or out of a Patriot Act or anything else. But nevertheless, the fact that on the eve of these elections, there will be tens of thousands of people marching around this country, I think is good news.
And Jim, you can share some good news with us with regards to the police policies in Los Angeles toward protesters.
Yeah, thank you, Heidi. I'm very proud of what the Lawyers Guild has been able to do here in Los Angeles, and I think it can be a model for elsewhere. It kind of, in broad strokes, represents a 1-2 punch. Whenever the police in the last 5, 6, 7 years have done anything wrong, and I mean anything at all, we sue them immediately. The other thing we do is we work with all of the groups that are protesting ahead of the time of their protest. We help them organize. We sit down and meet with the police departments beforehand. We get to know the same police departments that we've been suing in court and winning. We haven't lost anything in court yet on any of these lawsuits. So between, it's kind of like the old joke about bricking the donkey, you know. So you knock them around in court. We get huge settlements from them, both in terms of injunctive relief and in terms of money damages. And then we're out there in the streets to make sure that we don't give up literally an inch. And I mean that quite literally. We've actually had situations where a number of us have said to the police, you can arrest us because we're not going to move one inch further away from where you say our permit extends to this line, and yes, you're on our line, and we're not going to give you an inch of that line. I mean, it literally gets to be that important. We're very proud of the fact that when the president, for example, comes to town in L.A. as opposed to some other cities, if he's in a particular hotel, we're on the sidewalks in front of that hotel. So while police abuse in the dark of the night in the poor neighborhoods of L.A. is still a serious problem, in fact, I would say L.A. is now the safest city in America to hold a large demonstration, including demonstrations against police abuse, which we just had without any incidents whatsoever, despite the fact that the police are not thrilled to have anti-police demonstrators in their face.
I still wouldn't live there because of the San Andreas Fault. That makes to me the most dangerous city in America.
It wasn't San Andreas' fault. Jim, in a nutshell, tell our listeners, where do we want to be and how do we get there? Where do we go from here?
You know, I think the dialogue that Michael Ratten and I were having a moment ago is the answer to that question. I think people do have to recognize, from my point of view, that hope lies not with politicians who are all in bed with corporate America to one degree or another, but hope lies with themselves and with their neighbors, and that the best way to defend freedom of speech is to speak. The best way to defend freedom of assembly is to assemble, and so forth. To understand that when repression comes to any country, it does not descend on it as a general rule in one fell swoop. It comes incrementally. At first, only its earliest victims tend to notice it, in this case, immigrants, Muslims, Arabs, protesters. But if we're not careful, one day we wake up and that repression is complete. And so our hope lies with ourselves. And to the extent that we exercise those rights, we become a formidable force. And as Arundhati Roy likes to say, we be many and they be few. And if we remember that, and if we don't lose our courage and don't lose heart, which I have not, and which I think so many in the movement have not, I think our day will come, and I think this period of repression can be resisted and reversed.
Great statement, Jim. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Jim.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.